It does not sound like a cakewalk being a panelist on Reality Exploit Roundtable.
No.
How hard is it?
No, it's really hard.
What is the most difficult thing about the Reality Exploit Roundtable panelist lifestyle?
You gotta deal with the fans, especially the girls. No, it's definitely not for everyone. But if you like rocking deep into the night and partying hard all day, then it might be the life for you.
When all you have is a search engine, everything looks like a database.
Man, I have like a cypherpunk hard on right now.
Privacy is nothing to be granted. Privacy is something you take yourself.
They've got the Mossad, the CIA, and Hillary Clinton behind them.
We're now beyond what the Stasi could even dream of.
Reality Exploit Roundtable.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Episode 7 of Reality Exploit Roundtable. Today, I'll be your moderator. This is Hero. Welcome to the show, our panelist, Voodoo.
Hey there.
Hello, Wise Guy.
Hey.
Smuggler's back with us today.
Buenos dias.
And the real Plato.
Yo!
Let's go ahead and kick off the show today with our first topic. Today, we're going to talk about Spain's poor, time is money. And we have a report from Madrid.
Even though she's one of millions of young unemployed Spaniards, 22-year-old Silvia Martin takes comfort in knowing that her bank is still standing behind her. It's not a lending institution, but rather a time bank, whose nearly 400 members barter their services by the hour. The time bank not only saves her cash, she says, but also lifts her spirits by making her feel part of a community that's taking some positive action during hard times. Besides time banks, they include barter markets springing up in barrios, local currencies designed to spur the flagging retail economy, and charity networks that repurpose discarded goods. An environmental group recently launched Huertos Compartidos, or shared gardens that links up owners of vacant land with those willing to plant vegetables in them and share the harvest. Some statist economists are scared shitless about these alternate systems. One of them is José García Montalvo, an economics professor at the University of Pompeu Fabra in Barcelona.
It is pushing more of Spain's economy underground out of the view of our authorities, our regulators and tax collectors, and effectively sending our country back in time developmentally. Social currencies and time banks also preclude taking on debt, hence which in moderate levels can help people start businesses and access beneficial goods and services that they can't afford upfront. Time banks and social currencies can backfire on the broader economy since the income received from such arrangements often goes undeclared, therefore depriving the government of tax revenue.
Laia Serrano, 38, an economist, says,
I think the model of the welfare state has reached its limit, and it's up to individual members of society to pull our chestnuts out of the fire.
This is Anna Dunbom, reporting for Reality Exploit Roundtable, live from Madrid. Back to you, Hero.
Plato, is this just a fad of people in crisis, just another one of these disaster relief community organization efforts? Or, you know, and the title of this article says, for Spain's poor, is this something about the poor? Or is this something where we're seeing communities worldwide starting to reassess their relationships and activities in the midst of collapsing welfare states?
Well, it's both. The poor are the first ones who are adopting alternative currencies like this ECO that Spain has just launched. But it is a global trend because there's more and more poor people worldwide as everybody's pension funds collapse and investments tank and people start to realize that their governments really are not strong enough to do everything on their own. We're starting to see a trend towards resilience where individual communities realize that the best way for them to survive and prosper is for them to stay local and trade locally and work together instead of trying to, you know, all go all through this central bureaucracy.
An interesting thing about these let's currency, these time currencies, is that it's a debt instrument. You have to go into debt to start using these things. And that's why these communities don't just use the change they have in their pockets. A lot of people say, well, there's not enough silver to go around, so we had to create these community currencies. No, it's a debt instrument. You the first time you use it, you go to your doctor or you go to the local market and you say, I'll give you 2 hours of my time for a head of lettuce. That's a debt right there that you owe. You're going into debt by using it. And that's what these poor communities really need. They need access to credit, not some new currency. There's plenty of currencies out there they could use. They need the access to credit.
Okay, Voodoo, so you're not saying something against this as being a debt instrument?
No, I don't think so. I think what they need is the credit to be able to... They've got a problem. The first mover has to have enough money to let the second mover go. So if you're running a co-op and you're planting vegetables and you're using seeds that you already have and land that you already have, if no one has credit, they cannot purchase those vegetables. So they either have to go into their savings or they have to work someplace else outside of the community and bring that money in to then be able to purchase your vegetables. And so that's what these community currencies allow you to do. Instead of that, though, I think these community currencies have a lot of problems because they end up hyperinflating and there's a, how do you compare an hour's worth of doctor's time to an hour's worth of gardener's time or mechanic's time? That doesn't really work that way. I'd rather see them use either, like a silver or bitcoins or something like that, something that's established, but have access to credit to be able to start their co-op in the first place.
I agree.
I like the dichotomy between the credit in this local community and the credit in our current, global financial structure, because they're very different things. If I want to start a business, I have to basically borrow money from JP Morgan or Wells Fargo. And those guys don't have my interest at heart. They're going to soullessly come after me and foreclose my property if I'm late on a couple payments and like try and get their money. But if I'm in a resilient community of a few thousand people and I have a solid reputation, it's a lot easier to get them to each chip in a couple $100 and maybe some labor to build my barn or whatever. And if I run into arrears, if the barn burns down and I run into problems, they're going to be more understanding and more willing to work with me than, Goldman Sachs.
Actually, Plato, I'm not too sure about the whole thought you have there on credit. There's one good thing about banks that have no interest in you personally. There's also that they have no, preconceived notion about who you are or what is the right job to do in your community. If you want to do something that really outside the ordinary for your community, but has been done somewhere in the realm that the bank is operating in, then the bank is the more likely for you. The other thing I have a problem with in this whole regard is most of the currency systems usually the same amount of time is the same ever. Essentially, buying 1 hour for doctor is like buying 1 hour from someone doing a help job in the garden. So I don't think that's a good thing to start a specialization and cooperation economy on.
Fair point.
Especially if you get in arrears all these hours. So I'm 10,000 hours in the hole here. Am I going to work my butt off for 10,000 hours, or am I going to maybe phone it in for 10,000 hours? There's no qualifier there that says I have to produce X amount per hour.
Yeah, I could see how the system, you need both systems. Smuggler, that's a great point that banks may be willing to lend for some activities that your community might not. And vice versa. So I could see that both systems coexisting, although, I would prefer to see banks that use silver and gold and bitcoins instead of just fiat money.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
I think on a small scale, these things can be useful in a small community when you're keeping track of people that are doing stuff amongst each other. And as long as the system is available where, you know, a doctor may say, go ahead, you babysit for me for so many hours, and then I'll do a consultancy for you for so many hours. As long as people can exchange 2 hours for 1 hour or something like that, the system can be more open. And also, as far as it being a death instrument, when you're in a smaller environment and the books are more open, you can actually see what type of money is being lent out. If somebody's starting to overextend themselves where they owe the community like 10,000 hours, well, the community can have a thing in there where after anyone is over 40 hours in debt, they have to immediately pay that off within a certain amount of time, or they are not going to be extended anymore inside the system. So I think that some of the criticisms can be addressed. And the bigger issue is that these people are looking toward alternate systems. On the Cypherpunk show last year, we had Matthew Slater, who is a big community currency guy. And a lot of these people are looking in the right direction and looking for alternative systems. And right now, the Let's thing is basically the only accounting system that they're coming up with. And I think that looking toward systems like Loom, where you can monetize assets, and also open transactions, and of course Bitcoin is something in the future. Next topic. On several of our shows recently, we've discussed microfab, and it appears the U.S. government is very excited about this microfab technology and is throwing a bunch of money at it. Let's roll that clip.
The Obama administration recently announced the creation of the National Additive Manufacturing Innovation Institute, NAMII, in Youngstown, Ohio, and a public-private consortium of manufacturing firms, universities, community colleges, and nonprofits from the Ohio, West Virginia, Pennsylvania Tech Belt co-investing with the federal government. The seed money, $30 million from the U.S. Department of Defense, will be matched by $40 million from the consortium, the natural result of such technology, absent massive state intervention to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat on behalf of the corporate economy, is radical democratization of production. Open source CNC machinery possesses the same qualities as craft tools of 200 or 300 years ago, cheap, general purpose, flexible, and amenable to small-scale production on a demand-pull basis. The whole aim of U.S. economic policy under both Democrats and Republicans is essentially Hamiltonian, to counter the radical deflationary threat of abundance and ephemeralization through artificial scarcity. To prevent technologies of abundance from deflating the economy, destroying trillions in exchange value, making most investment capital superfluous, and radically reducing work hours, it's necessary to make them artificially expensive and raise the capital outlays and overhead required to adopt them. Fortunately, it won't work. If you think the music industry has a hard time combating file sharing, just wait till the old line manufacturing companies try to prevent hundreds of thousands of hardware hackers in neighborhood garage factories from replicating pirated industrial designs on CAD files from the Pirate Bay.
Wow.
Wise guy, the additive manufacturer money recipients in this story are defense contractors. Seems like someone is handing out grant money that doesn't get the real impact of this technology.
Oh, they get it. Industrial companies are major political supporters in the U.S., so this recent Obama administration announcement of NAMI should come as no surprise. It's just a small payback for this support. However, the article in question says that the initiative is really working to regulate, cartelize, and enclose the market for additive manufacturing. What it's trying to do is to lock up all of the intellectual property, and in that way, somehow entrench the manufacturers that are part of this cartel to take advantage of it. And of course, the Defense Department will be there to try to create export restrictions. If this is really their purpose, I'm afraid the horses already left that barn a long time ago. As the audio clip says, the ability for the component files to be peer-to-peer distributed by places like Pirate Bay, and the ability for the 3D printers to replicate themselves, which is really a fantastic achievement, is that the manufacturer of most of all of their mechanical components, this will guarantee that no regulatory curtain will prevail. So I'm really not seeing this happening.
I think that the impact of this is going to be felt less in the United States, actually, than it will in China. And I could go into that if people are interested. But I definitely think that U.S. manufacturing is being so automated now, and so few jobs are returning, that it'll be less impactful to the Western manufacturers, especially the U.S., than China, which is very labor-intensive types of manufacturing.
Yeah, but you don't do production manufacturing with this additive process. This is great for rapid prototyping, but I don't, you know, there injection molding is a lot better method for production of, you know, mass producing goods than this additive process.
But it's pretty good for building the tools for doing molding and stuff like that.
Yeah. And
or if you're only trying to produce enough, you know, plastic cups for your party tomorrow or for your church, small-scale manufacturing, it would work fine.
Right, and especially when it comes to manufacture on demand, where you can manufacture something locally on demand, like hours before you need it.
I think Neil Stephenson's Diamond Age really focuses on what the impact of having this kind of manufacturing capability in everyone's homes might have on society. And it's a good read. And it really does revolution. It's really a second industrial revolution. As the cost of these devices comes down to perhaps what a printer costs, a desktop printer, then many people will decide that instead of buying goods that are manufactured in China or some other low-cost country, or maybe even locally by some large manufacturer, they can turn out these things themselves when they just need one or two of them.
Right, but look at it. They already have that with printers that print on paper. I mean, I'm not talking this down. I love 3D printing and I have one myself. But the thing really is, I have a paper printer already, you know, and I could print a book, but I don't, because I don't want to go through the troubles. It still costs money, so it's easier for me to order it via a big online book retailer, have it in the mail tomorrow, and I'm happy anyways.
If anyone is new to the maker scene and hasn't really looked into 3D printing, go on YouTube and search for Ultra Maker. It's a recent 3D printer, and it's really fast, it's really high resolution, and it's a good picture of the current state of the art.
Yeah, but the problem goes even more fundamental than not wanting to print it out, like Smuggler was saying, not wanting to print out a book. In this case, you have to write your own book to be able to print it out. I know they're talking about sending these files over, but this it's so infantile right now, or it's such in its infancy. These are not easy things to do. CAD/CAM programs are not easy to work with right now. Not easy enough for the standard desktop user. I think if this gets used at all, it gets used by folks who are already doing manufacturing processes. They're already using lathes and mills and probably CNC machines. Those are the most likely users. You might be pushing some production from, you know, mega corporation A down to local artisan B, but not enough to make a difference. And you're certainly not going to be pushing the production into your own living room.
Well, absolutely right. And in Silicon Valley, according to a recent New York Times article, the ability to do rapid prototyping, largely due to 3D printing, is representing a significant shift back to hardware design development. And what's going on is that although the final hardware is being manufactured not in Silicon Valley, but in China or some other low-cost country, it's being conceived, designed, prototyped, and financed here, usually by small startups. So you're absolutely right. This is having an initial effect on the people who design and develop products and shortening their development cycles and their costs and getting them closer to you know, market timing and improving the consumer experience.
Well, I can say that if I actually did have a printer that printed a book, I'd probably use it rather than the printer that just spits out a bunch of pieces of paper. It would be nice to just, you know, throw a PDF at it and a few minutes later walk over there and you have a nice little bound book with a cover and everything. Let's move on to the next topic. Trackable banknotes.
Researchers at the Functional Nanomaterials and Devices Laboratory at the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology are working on putting a memory device into banknotes. As in the U.S. $20 bills, the purpose is to cut down on counterfeiting, but unlike them, the Saudi system has some electronics on board. It can send an RFID radio signal to a scanner, and it contains some non-volatile memory that can store a record of it every time it's scanned. The research is described in a new article in the Wiley Journal, Advanced Materials. The article is titled, High-Performance Non-Volatile Organic Ferroelectric Memory on Banknotes. Once there are enough bills and scanners out there, and bills are routinely, you know, have this embedded in it and are scanned at every transaction, which is in principle possible, there's the potential for quite a database of how money changes hands. Would this let, say, a government go after drug traffickers, for example?
Absolutely, especially in large denominations. I think the circuit can become as complex as you want it to be, right? I mean, in its simplest form, the circuit is not very expensive, and it can be quite simple to implement, actually. But if you want inventory and tracking and positioning, you know, and like this, you could basically add functionality to the circuit. And this can also, again, be done with organic materials and go beyond just knowing what this is, a bona fide government-issued banknote or not. You could go, into tracking and locating banknotes and so forth. You know, it just you design the circuit that you want to appear on the banknote.
And so it could also help a government go after the so-called gray economy, like waiters and cab drivers and everybody else who works mainly in cash and might be underreporting their income.
It could, but that was not our intention.
I mean, it could be used by a government for any reason, right? I mean, if the government wants to track who's purchasing alcohol or something.
Yeah, I think actually you're bringing up some ideas. We didn't really entirely think about all of those. You know, counterfeiting definitely was one of the leading things, but these are all interesting applications.
Yeah, interesting applications. While he's laughing, thinking about some of these other regimes that he could sell this technology to for oppression that he didn't think of originally. So smuggler, to me, this seems like turning every type of piece of cash into some type of bearer instrument that's trackable, barely different from credit cards. And they're talking about using it for anti-counterfeiting and detecting drug trafficking and the like. It seems to me that there's a whole world of people out there that no matter what kind of electronic tracking device that they put out there, whether it's the credit cards or these type of bills, they're going to look at some type of cash that they can hold in their hands and that they can exchange, whether it's in system D or other money movements. What do you think about this? These bills and one on the hardware end, can any of these things be fried with microwave?
Well, the thing is, I wouldn't really fry them with microwave. There are much smarter things to do, like using a zapper for it, which actually is just an electron pulse that you put in there. You essentially it's an antenna that fries the circuits, which is what you do to fry RF, essentially. The thing with this technology is that it's actually not so new. I mean, the new part on it is that it's done with organic circuitry, while in the past there were attempts to do that. Silicon, like Hitachi, had a system like that in 2003, I think, and there were talks about putting an RFID chip in every big banknote in Europe. But the thing really is, that's really a pretty dumb idea, because if the chip in it is required for the bank to be burned, then someone with a zapper, something that burns their chip, could turn a lot of money around him into paper without value. If it's not interesting for the validity of the money, then well, people will simply zap it and go untracked, so to speak. The last thing I would like to add to that is the problem is with cash is not really that it's untrackable. It is trackable always. There are serial numbers on it, and this is exactly what is done in sting operation. The agents will, spread out the money, take photos of that, and then later check if you have money with the same serial number. So money is always trackable because of numbers on it, and it's just a question of will someone have an OCR device. So I think what will really happen with that kind of technology is that the pickpocket that's standing behind me right now can count the money in my wallet before stealing it.
Yeah, so this sounds like a complete fail from all directions. On a previous episode, we talked about a lot of this surveillance technology not necessarily being something that a bunch of evil status guys are just trying to eliminate, but actually a lot of it's being driven, this new technology, the bigger bombs and all these type of things, they're being driven by people coming up with ways to get government contracts, and this sounds completely like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, one interesting idea with U.S. currency, in the United States, it's very often that the higher bills, perhaps maybe not the 20s, but more frequently the 50s and certainly the 100s, they'd use these pens and they'd swipe them across the bill in order to detect if they might be counterfeit. The way those pens work is they have an iodine chemical in them that reacts with cheap bond paper, which typically has a starch coating to it. Of course, anyone that knows what they're doing is not going to use that paper, but they still think it works. And so one interesting exploit against that system and against all of the people using these pens, which are legion around the U.S., is to just get some spray starch and spray all your money with it and put it into circulation and see what happens.
And the amazing Randy did a demonstration, too, using that pen, how easy it was to fool with cheap bond paper that somehow did not have the starch in it.
Yeah, actually, manufacturing U.S. currency is pretty straightforward. And there was a book about it, in fact, that talked about that long ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago it came out. And what that guy did is he found very thin newsprint, which doesn't have those coatings that react to the pens, but was important because the newsprint was very thin, it was very cheap, and it had the look and feel of the paper that it's not paper, it's cloth that the banknotes are made out of in the United States. But the thinness enabled him to print the the Ben Franklin image, which is normally inside the bill, then to laminate the two pieces of paper together, and it'd be inside the bill, just like the stuff from the Treasury Department. And then he went ahead and did all the rest of the work that he would do to print it. And it turned out he passed a huge amount of money and only got caught because he was turned in by somebody who was trying to screw him.
While we're talking about the counterfeiting here, I want to go back just one second to our first topic, the Spanish Letz currencies. And the Wall Street Journal video that's in our show notes, it points out that a lot of Letz systems fail due to counterfeiting. If you're making your own currency, you might not be able to make it as well as, the U.S. Treasury. And so any fool with an inkjet printer can just go and print it and say, hey, I got these from the guy down the street. I have some money. So I think that until we see systems like that are backed by open transactions and digital signatures, that's going to be a severe weakness to that type of Letz system.
Well, one way that you can utilize a Letz system and reduce the counterfeiting is to attach value to ready circulating notes of very low denomination. In the United States, we have $1 notes. And if you can track those notes and make them the paper for these transactions, then the cost of all of the security measures has been absorbed by the Treasury Department printing those bills for you.
Oh, that's cool. So you could just stamp a little unique QR code on it, and you scan the QR code, and it pulls up a site that says, hey, this bill should have serial number blah, blah, blah. If it does, it's legit. If it's not, it's not.
Or just have a mobile database with the serial numbers in it, and just issue new money like that.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Then you're not doing a legal defacement, and it's not counterfeitable, and it's trackable in the central database. Yeah, that's good ideas.
Well, one of the problems with the Letz that hasn't been mentioned, was sort of alluded to, is Letz usually collapse because the more successful they are, the more commerce they displace from the regular currency, which can be easily exchanged for goods and services outside of the community. So if Letz winds up being most of the currency in circulation in that community, then people can't buy anything from outside the community.
Yeah, in the Cypherpunk show, we talked about a settlement system where independent, where people could settle amongst themselves. And this would be similar to some of the other like loom type systems. How would people exchange stuff back and forth from within a loom? And that would be people having accounts and doing cross settlement and exchanges. There's lots of ways that can be done. It's just that a lot of people haven't done it yet. Voodoo, you were going to say something?
Well, back on counterfeiting and the RFID, there's all this concern about counterfeiting the paper, but how come there's no concern about counterfeiting that goes on within the computer at the bank and at the Fed? Who's handing out the serial numbers for those bills that are being created?
That's the difference between a licensed and a non-licensed criminal.
Right. Yep. And the anti, these guys, again, why? You'll hear so much about it because you don't get government contracts for trying to figure out ways to keep the Fed from counterfeiting. You get government contracts from coming up with new technology to sell to them for not to avoid counterfeiting of their own currencies.
In other words, open competition by the consumers.
And all the electronic notes, everybody is, you know, we know that those are legitimate and they're in the right place. And that's not drug money.
Well, you know, one of the issues that's been brought up is that all of this money that supposedly is being printed by the Federal Reserve Bank and other central banks has actually been put into the reserves of banks in order to prop up their balance sheets and over time recapitalize them. But most of that money is not finding itself into circulation because it's being used as reserves. And unless and until the money gets lent out, it isn't in circulation. So people, if there was a widespread use of counterfeit money that was so good, like, for instance, the super notes that supposedly came from North Korea, if those started to circulate in the wider economy, while they might start to have an inflationary effect, it would actually achieve the goal that the Obama administration has been pushing, which is to get more economic activity.
Yeah, it's the exact same game plan that Robert Mugabe and Gideon Ono used in Zimbabwe.
With lack of control, that is.
All right, guys, good stuff. Let's move on to our final topic here. Florida deputy has a spidey sense.
Orlando, Florida.
Walk away from there, okay?
That's a direct order. Do it now.
Last May, Sarasota, Florida Sheriff's Deputy Dominic Forno followed Joseph McNeil's Jaguar out of a parking lot, then pulled McNeil over. The reason? Forno claimed he could smell marijuana coming from the car, even though the car was traveling at 35 miles per hour, and the windows were up. Oh, and there was no marijuana in the car. Forno arrested McNeil and charged him with a DUI, though, even though McNeil's back was about half the legal limit, Forno's dash cam and wireless microphone clearly show McNeil denying the search. More deputies arrived. They brought in the drug dog, which miraculously didn't alert. They searched the car anyway based solely on Deputy Forno's obvious olfactory gifts. He must have some bloodhound in him. They searched his socks. Tore up the car, put in lines in his car, nothing. They brought in the drug dog, nothing. 90 minutes later, they turn off the police microphone and another cop finds a burnt marijuana joint in the trunk. Later, all charges are dropped. No compensation was given for property damage. Fornell's supervisor, Major Kevin Kenny, described that search is going a little too far, though overall, he stands by the deputy's actions at night. Kenny said his deputy operated entirely with the department policy.
Voodoo, it's interesting. In many countries, cops try to pull shit like this in order to get some type of a bribe or extort money out of the victim. But in the United States, it seems like these guys that are already well paid are just looking to crack some skulls. What's going on with this? How can what can be done about this?
Well, that's the question. Is why? Why are stops like this happening? Why do they have to search the car and they tear it apart and they don't find anything? And so then they become destructive and then eventually plant evidence on the guy. It's all about generating PC. It's all about generating probable cause. The guy said he smelled, the cop said he smelled marijuana coming from this car that was driving by with the windows closed, you know, and All right, fine. He had a suspicion. Why can't he just say that? Why do we have to jump through these hoops and say that, well, no, he really had probable cause because then he called the drug dog and the drug dog alerted. You know, that's what the courts will accept. They'll accept the drug dogs that are provably inefficient or ineffective at actually finding drugs. That doesn't stop them from making claims about these dogs that can't possibly be true about how about their efficacy. But as long as the dog has the training and a certification of training, the court accepts it as probable cause for the search. It's just the courts have rejected time and time again the actual science behind these drug dogs that shows that they can't possibly do what the police claim they're doing, and so they're just used to manufacture PC. In Washington State, the Supreme Court looked at a case where the dog alerted 60 on 60 out of 63 cars that he was shown, and only a 66% hit rate. And they said, you know what? It doesn't matter the hit rate. What matters is the dog had the training certificate from the school. And so the scam is just to set up the certification school. That happens time and time again. But they say, oh, the dog didn't actually falsely alert. What it was, he was reacting to the aura of contraband past. You know, there used to be marijuana in this car sometime in the past 10 years or something. And there's no way to say that's false. You know, maybe there was marijuana in there, or maybe that they're just making it up. UC Davis did a study where they had 18 drug dogs go through four rooms in a church. And they said there may be up to three targets, either explosives or drugs, in each of these rooms. And they had 18 dogs and their handlers go through these rooms. The dogs alerted 200 times in those four rooms. There were no drugs. There were no explosives in those rooms. So it was a 100% false alert rate. Well, it doesn't matter because there's no double-blind trials of these dogs. If they did double-blind trials, it would show that they're a complete dowsing rod. They're just canine dowsing rods. Back to your original question, what can be done about it? Nothing with the current criminal justice system. The system is absolutely irreparable. You can't fix it. You can't reform it. Throw the baby out with the bathwater on it. The goal of the current system is the preservation of the system. The cops are there for the preservation of the cops. The courts are there for the preservation of the courts. And so no reform can happen there. We can't evolve societally to a better criminal justice system until private alternatives to the cops and courts become the norm.
Smuggler, do you see this type of attitude in Europe where the police are really out there looking to crack skulls?
To a lesser degree. Of course, even here we have bad cops, but it's not prevalent as in the United States.
Well, they might as well bring in psychics as using these dogs as dowsing rods.
I mean, sorry. Please don't blame the dogs for it. Please.
Go ahead, Voodoo.
They might as well use psychics as using these dogs. The bottom line is that the police officer's own intuition is a lot better statistically than the dog on the PC.
Well, when you say better, you mean that the police officer's intuition is what's leading the dog to alert, right? Because it's not like the cop actually does have spidey sense and he can figure out that there's marijuana in the car. He can just get his dog to alert.
Right. So like this Washington State, the dog was brought out 63 different times. He alerted 60 times. And even though he only found contraband 66% of the time, the idea is because the dog was brought out, it automatically alerted. Think about it. The hit rate, if he would have alerted on all 63 cars instead of 60, would be virtually the same. But if he takes a pass on, say, four or five more of those cars, his efficacy rate skyrockets from that 66%.
Yeah, so in the economic terms of what's going on here, the police will use these dogs in order to essentially trigger probable cause. this is their they can bring out a dog as a pretext to do something at which that they had no probable cause to begin with. So it's in their best interest in order to push these dogs as being a legitimate tool, regardless of their statistics, because it gives them that pretext that they normally could not just declare.
Doesn't this type of behavior sort of beg for people to run false flags on them with, you know, control groups from like federal agencies trying to bust them doing this stuff?
It is, but that takes money. Look at what Barry Cooper tried to do with cop busters until he got into a bunch of trouble down in Odessa. With cop busters, he tried to set up a fake grow house, and he did end up getting a no-knock raid on the house, and they found 3 Christmas trees in there and a bunch of cameras filming them. But all of that costs money, and so you need somebody to fund that. And you would think defense lawyers, you know, the bar and especially defense lawyers would be willing to pony up money to do double-blind trials on these dogs to say, no kidding, this is just hokum. But their bread and butter cases are these drug cases, and they don't want to shoot they don't want to lose their goose that lays the golden egg any more than the prosecutors do.
So everyone is in on it, except the consumer or citizen.
Absolutely, and the goal is to propagate the system, keep the criminal justice system going. They don't care about criminality. They don't care about justice. They care that the system keeps going and it keeps cranking out. Keeps cranking out lawyers, keeps cranking out judgments, keeps cranking out cattle that we can put in cages and get money for.
So what should I do if an officer threatens to call up a drug dog? Because my impression is that if I get pulled over and a cop says, hey, can I search your car? I respond, no, you can't search my car. I want to leave. Am I free to go? And at that point, he'll say, no, you're not. I'm going to call in a drug dog. And he'll go back to his car and wait like half an hour. And then the drug dog comes and alerts, and they search and tear my car apart. And I, you know, they plant some evidence and I go to jail. But my impression is that at least if I'm denying the search and constantly asking to go, I have some legal ammunition in court that the cops are holding me there for a long time without actual probable cause. And maybe that's certainly a better defense than letting him search.
Absolutely. And I would say, you know, I don't have any statistics to back this up, but I'd say 9 out of 10 times you'd also be calling his bluff. You know, well, can I search your car? I don't consent to any searches. Well, I could have a drug dog out here come take a look, sniff around the car. He's going to find anything. That'll give me probable cause. Oh, well, you got to do what you got to do. And that'll be calling their bluff most of the time.
Yeah, that's one thing that has become a big problem with people on the road is they've been so complacent when an officer asks to search their car, they just give him carte blanche access. When if a police officer just went around knocking on people's doors and saying, can I come into your house and look around? Most people now today would just tell them no, come back with a warrant or like get out of here or something like that. Even in today's society, people just aren't opening doors and just letting police like wander around their house. But when you're out in a car, people tend to just say, go ahead, go ahead, go ahead. And because I have nothing to hide. Well, they don't do that in their house saying I don't have anything to hide. So go ahead and come in here and look around. So, you know, it's the same thing with like, using encryption and some of those other things. Because the people are so, they have made it so easy for government and other people to spy on their stuff and to come into their cars that it's become a normal operation. Whereas what you just said, where you're calling their bluff, that should be the norm where the police know that they're not going to, that they're going to have to threaten everybody with a police dog rather than just getting immediate access to their cars.
It's hard to say no to cops because they understand how to push your buttons and how to get you to consent to that search. So one nice line that I've heard is officer asks, can I search your car? You say, no, I don't consent to searches. Officer says, well, why not? Do you have something to hide? And you simply say, well, isn't that what lawyers say? You don't consent to searches.
I saw some floor mats on sale, ones to go in front of your door, doormats, it says, come back with a warrant.
Yeah, get a bumper sticker on your car like that, and I'm sure that they'll leave you alone.
It would be interesting.
All right, I'd like to thank all the panelists today. This has been a good show. Episode 7, you can check us out at agoristradio.com on the Reality Exploit Roundtable page and on GitHub and on our panelist. Voodoo, go ahead and make your plug.
All right, if you're looking for agorist businesses, come on over to blackandyellowpages.com, all one word, blackandyellowpages.com. If you have an agorist business and you would like to list a free listing on Black and Yellow Pages, just send me an email at voodoo@blackandyellowpages.com, and I will send you an invite.
Smuggler.
If you're interested in crypto travel writings and similar, go to anaplex.net. We also have an IRC server for people interested in agorism and cypherpunk. And also check out ShadowCC, which is an upcoming venture on privacy technology.
Thanks. Plato?
Well, if you want to get in touch with me, yell at me for factual inconsistencies in this podcast, or just say hi, you can reach me on Reddit or Twitter or GitHub. My username is TheRealPlato on all of those. And if you're looking for an interesting homepage with a lot of nice ANCAP content, check out dailyancap.com.
All right, and this is Hero. You can check out some of my other podcasts that I do on my own and with other guests. We have the Coinbase Bitcoin podcast, Cypherpunked, and the Agorist Social Club, and of course, the Reality Exploit Roundtable. Check it all out on agoristradio.bit or .com. Thanks again, panelists, and everyone for listening. This has been Episode 7 of Reality Exploit Roundtable.
Hey, you didn't give me time for my plug.
Go ahead, wise guy. I'll stick it in.
Well, I'm not involved in any legal activities that I can mention, so I have nothing to plug.
Alaska Force. Walk away from there, okay?
That's a direct order.